Good morning. Are you taking a battering? Storm Kathleen is hitting.
Tie down the trampolines.
And everything else. A status yellow wind warning for the entire country and a status orange wind warning for Cork, Kerry, Waterford, Galway and Mayo. But keep an eye on Met Éireann for those updates. On the News at One yesterday with Gavin, Keith Leonard of the National Directorate for Fire and Emergency Management.
What are we expecting?
Gavin, this is a dynamic storm, and I suppose we met this morning and we heard from Met Éireann that we're going to have kind of very severe winds in Kerry, Cork, Waterford, Galway and Mayo. But really it's going to be a very windy and kind of wet day across the country tomorrow. And I suppose, look, you know, this is kind of a bit late in the season typically for these storms. So it might take people unawares. But I suppose one of our key safety messages, Gavin, would be for people to stay away from coastal areas across the country because conditions are going to be difficult right across the country and particularly in those coastal areas.
Is it unprecedented or unusual for this team that you're chairing to meet in April?
It's unusual, I would say that, Gavin. I can't recall the last time that we met in April. Certainly, typically at this stage of the year, conditions will be tended to be drying out. But unfortunately, it looks like we're in that kind of unsettled Atlantic regime for the weekend and possibly well into next week.
From the News at One yesterday, and all of that on top of the rain that just will not stop.
As the wet weather continues, farmers have warned of a possible potato shortage later in the year because crops can't be planted in waterlogged fields. Last month, rainfall exceeded the norm in almost all counties in Ireland. Farm leaders have called on the government, banks and credit unions to support farmers. Our agriculture correspondent, Joe McGrailey.
There will be no relief from rainfall and sodden ground for farmers for some time yet. As Met Éireann's farming forecast says, rainfall amounts will be 2 to 4 times the normal range over the coming days. Farmers can expect showers and longer periods of rainfall, interspersed with some brighter spells too. The forecaster's analysis of last month's weather, published today, confirms very high rainfall at stations in parts of the country. Valentia County Kerry had 194% of its long-term average amount, while Dublin Airport had 219% of the average. Overall, 21 of 25 weather stations around the country recorded rainfall in excess of the norm, with 4 stations in the west and northwest recording slightly below average amounts.
Oy, and while it's grim for everyone, if you are working on the land or with animals, it has potentially very serious consequences. Dr. Joe Patton from Chagask spoke to Mary on Morning Ireland about the wet fields.
It's certainly approaching or maybe has passed a crisis point at this stage, I would say. We have to remember this is not just a recent thing. Really, poor weather has been occurring on really farms have been feeling the effects since the end of last summer, actually. So that's generally when we really see a problem. It has been extended through the autumn into the winter period. And obviously now, as farmers want to start getting their spring work and their field work underway and grazing and getting animals out to grass, all that kind of stuff done, they're just completely stymied at the moment. So really, it is it's a very stressful period, and we're pushing towards the point where the options and the mitigations that people can do are beginning to be exhausted in some places. So yeah, it's certainly a stressful time.
Stress and financial costs.
Like, we would estimate that at the moment, a wet week at this moment is probably costing dairy farmers in the region of possibly up to 30 million euros on a national scale per week, probably something similar for beef farmers. And if you take tillage and the tillage and crop sector, probably similar as well. So there's a very significant immediate cash cost. Mm. There's the cost of the psychological effect of not being able to get over that peak period. And also, I think, which is important to say too, that, you know, into the rest of the year, it will generate cash flow issues long into the year, and maybe, you know, issues around capital. Because one of the things I would say that, you know, farmers have been very good over the last number of years to build mitigation into their systems, but those mitigations would mean extra feed and extra cash in reserve. A lot of that's been used up now. So that will have to be replenished and replaced over the years. So this is not going to be something that when the sun starts shining, hopefully when it does, that it will all just disappear overnight. There will be certainly effects felt right into the whole year, I would say.
And on Thursday with Claire, Hazel Mullins, a dairy farmer and large animal vet, who talked about the pressure she and other farmers are experiencing.
You're in a unique position where you're meeting a lot of farmers through your work as a vet. Would you say it's taking a toll?
Certainly, yeah. I think it's any farmer that you meet, anyone, if you're not in a farming community, but you know a farmer, I'm sure if you ring them at the moment or talk to them at the moment, they're under a lot of stress. And, you know, even myself, I've felt, you know, very down days over the last couple of months, and it's hard.
And this disruption to the natural cycle is also affecting the cows.
Their routine is totally gone, basically. Mm. You know, they're confused. They want to go out, but then when they're out, they come in, and you know, there's silage available for them. Luckily, on our farm, we do have fodder. We're very lucky. So they do have food and they can come in. But look, they would love to be out. As I agree with Minister Hayden and Michael, they do want to be out.
Yeah, I saw a picture that you took of the cows this morning, standing at the gate, looking out at the grass. Do you think they're frustrated standing there looking at the grass that they can't get out to eat?
I think, well, I would, if they could talk, I'm sure they would say to us that they are. I think, look, there's nothing like seeing cows grazing outside and the freedom. Look, we're coming to the end of the calving season now, and unfortunately we're coming into the breeding season. It never stops here on the farm. So 1st of May is kind of peak breeding season, but they are coming into heat at the moment as well, which causes another trouble in sheds when, because of our seasonal calving pattern, a lot of cows are after calving, so a lot of cows will be coming into heat now, so they'll be ovulating and they'll be coming into heat, and unfortunately cows jump on other cows when they come into heat, so this can cause injuries in the shed. So I think I had 4 cows myself this morning, you know, in heat, which caused a little bit of trouble in the waiting yard. And look, in the fields doesn't cause an issue, but I have had colleagues go to a few injuries because of you know, cows coming into heat. So that's one problem at the moment, yeah.
And later that morning, the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnell-Logue, announced a pause in all non-essential farm inspections until April the 22nd and asked Teagasc to establish a system to help share surplus fodder. And while much of the focus was on dairy, tillage too was under pressure. The majority of spring crops should be in the ground by now, but given the weather, only about 2% have been sown. With Claire, farmer and tillage editor with the Farmers' Journal, Siobhan Walsh.
Tell me from your own perspective what things are like.
Yeah, I farm in County Leashere with my dad and my sister, and look, we struggled to get our winter crops in Clare. So they're crops that are sown in October and November. So it basically rained every day after we got those planted. Those crops now look very thin and patchy, so they're poor. We're going to get a poor yield out of those crops. And now since, you know, in springtime, we would usually start to plough maybe in January and February and get crops in March. And certainly by early April, we would have those crops in. But this year we have no crops in. So we will try and persist now to plant spring beans. There is a payment there from government to plant spring beans, so it makes sense to sow them, even though we probably will take a yield hit. And then malting barley is our other crop here on the farm. And it's a really important crop to many tillage farmers. But the later the sowing date is delayed, the more risk there is that barley won't pass for malt. So malting barley is used to produce beer and whiskey, and we need low proteins for that. And the protein gets higher as the sowing date is delayed. So if we don't get our malting barley in, we lose a premium of €70 per tonne on that crop. So it's a massive loss for farmers. But Claire, I'm conscious. I talk to farmers, you know, all across the country in my job every day. And, you know, we did quite well on our farm. There's farmers looking out at potatoes in the ground, sitting in water, at fields that they haven't been able to get into in their winter crops to put out fertiliser on. Some people can't walk in their fields, not to mind get a tractor in. So the situation in tillage at the minute is really dire, and farmers are really down at the minute, unfortunately.
From Clare Burn yesterday, and we can only hope for a little bit of dry weather, maybe even sunshine. Meanwhile, we have a water shortage. This week, environment correspondent George Lee had a series on Morning Ireland on the state of our water system. It is not in great shape, to put it mildly, particularly in the Greater Dublin area. And already this year, city slickers were being asked to conserve water.
How deep is the crisis now?
It's very deep. Actually, if you take in January, as you said, when we were asked to conserve water in the middle of the rainy season, the peak demand there was 636 million litres per day in the Greater Dublin area. What they can sustainably supply at the absolute maximum is 600, so we're well over it. The above supply demand was, there were no days during 2019 when we were above demand, above supply. By last year, 2023, 80 days. In the first 25 days of this year, 23 of those days, the demand for water in the Greater Dublin region was greater than what they could supply. So I don't know what it's been since then, but we've had a lot of rain, and we had a lot of rain then anyway. So it's about drinking water, not rainwater. And the problem is that we haven't had a new supply of water for the Greater Dublin area for 60 years. During that time, population I know of the country has gone from 3.5 million to 5.1 million, most of which is in that whole zone that they're talking about from the Midlands over. And there's no new supplies. You look at the situation where you've got a plan for 300,000 new houses in the country over the next 10 years. Where's the water going to come from? Where's the water going to come from for industry? So the issue is about we are desperately at the point now where we are facing an issue. If you're conserving water in the winter, you're going to be in trouble in the summer.
And they discussed a plan that has been knocking around for many years, Uisce Éireann's proposal to pump water from the Shannon to Dublin. But there are objections and nothing has been approved. Meanwhile, we are all turning on the taps and just letting it flow.
The analysis shows that on average per person, we're using 133 litres of water per day. Now, I'm not sure where my 133 litres of water per day are, and I'm sure you're not either, Mary. And some of it is there's about 7 to 10% of households do have significant leaks, and they drive up that average number because the leaks are huge. And when you look at the analysis, we're using it, I think it's 26% in toilets. So when they're not fixed properly, there's a huge amount of water goes out there. 28% showers and baths, 30% on our taps. We have dishwashers and washing machines, 12%, and gardens, about 4%.
It all adds up very
quickly. It all adds up.
Yeah. I'm sorry, pardon, 133 litres a day? It's conservation time. Margaret Attridge at Uisce Éireann had some top tips. Yes, fix those leaks for starters, but also, she says, run the dishwasher, only when full, mind you, and on eco. No rinsing. But there was more.
Do not leave that tap running when you're brushing your teeth. One of the biggest areas of saving in your bathroom is to shorten the length of your shower. So if you take Dublin, where we are here today, for example, 1.7 million people served by the water supplies are in the Dublin area. If one in four of those shower once a day, and if one in four of those people shorten their shower by 1 minute, we will save 5 million litres of water a day. So just small changes can make a huge difference to the resilience of our water supply schemes.
Oh, that is quite the saving. We may need to start timing our showers. And staying with something of a theme, with Miriam, John Connell, writer and Longford sheep farmer. His book is called 12 Sheep, Life Lessons from a Lambing Season.
Sheep are lovely, gentle creatures. Stubborn sometimes too, but they're quite noble in their own little right, you know. And it was a book that I've been wanting to write for a long time. I just didn't know how to do it. I had to study and read and learn and take a little journey inside, you know, in a sense. And I think being on a farm gives you an experience of being with nature. And I love getting up in the morning. My routine is I get up and I meditate, and then I go onto the farm and do my jobs. And then I come home and I write. And it's a pretty good life, you know. And
sounds idyllic. Yeah, I want it.
Yeah, and we have an organic farm, so it's even nicer. But I suppose, for people who are on the front lines of life, maybe reading a book like this can bring a little bit of green into their lives, you know. The book's coming out all around the world, so I hope people will be able to feel that that charisma of sheep and nature.
The charisma of sheep. And while all of this may sound very bucolic, John Connell might argue it's as relevant to hip cats in the city as it is to the country folk.
When you think of John McGahan's view of how the local is universal, I was thinking when I was reading your book, you know, there's such big questions raised in it. the environmental impact of keeping sheep, the abuse of migrant workers in food production, but a lot of it's so simple and local, as McGahan said.
Yeah, well, you know, I suppose I realised, Miriam, that the canvas is here. The canvas is in front of us. And that came as a realisation to me, but John McGarren had known it 20 years or 30 years before me. And but the local is the universe because it contains all the characters that we will ever meet. You know, I go to America at least once a year for film work in Los Angeles, and the same characters are there, you know. So there mightn't be the lad with the limp and the funny accent, but he's very likely to be somewhere in LA, you know. So I think that the rural characters make up the universe of life. And this book is the shortest book I've ever wrote. It's only 34,000 words. It took nearly 4 years to write. But the interesting thing was I was 7 years in Ireland when I began the book. And my old mentor, David Malouf, is an Australian writer. He told me once, he said, we're entirely new people every 7 years. New skin, new cell, new hair. So I think in a sense, I had become finally Irish in a sense. I'd lived away for so long at so many different places. I rerouted. And this book is about rootedness and rooting. And I talk about that, about rural communities in decline and the sense of rootedness. And, you know, if we have rootedness, we can have a thriving country, family, local universe. Cities are great, but they can't occupy a whole country. So no. We need the rural environment.
John Connell with Miriam. Now, can you guess the creature?
They are amongst the world's most intelligent creatures, capable of recognising themselves in the mirror test, making and using tools, and even working in teams.
It is the magpie, and on Bank Holiday Monday, Nature on One devoted a full hour to the bird. A relatively recent arrival here. Here is Professor Brendan Kavanagh speaking to Terry Flanagan.
The suggestion is that they came over about the middle of the 17th century, that they might have been blown over on a storm from somewhere in the UK, probably in Wales, and that they established a small population in Wexford at that particular time.
From Wales to Wexford. Now, they are primarily urban creatures, and moving around in built-up areas means they need to be agile. And this they achieve by means of their tail.
That tail is like a rudder on a ship. It's able to turn the bird very quickly in the air. And that helps them, number one, avoid being predated. It also helps them if they are chasing something else. They are more dexterous in terms of getting around. So all in all, the tail, and you'd often see them when they're playing with each other or sparring with each other. They're very versatile. They're able to dance around, and it's that tail that gives them that skill. And any skill that an animal has that another one hasn't is a positive advantage.
They are believed to mate for life, and as a young couple, so to speak, they both head out to find territory. And then it is nest building time. And what a nest. Here's ornithologist and author Eric Dempsey with Derek.
A magpie's nest is quite a spectacular thing, really, because it looks from the outside as just a bundle of twigs, and they're just like, you know, beginning to sort of just throw these twigs together. But it's quite a complex nest. Many birds, like thrushes, for example, use mud to sort of stabilise the nest, and so do magpies. Mm-hmm. Magpies use mud a bit like, almost like wattling, to create a stable nest, and they will usually build it quite high, and at where there's a sort of a juncture of about 10 branches, because it's quite a big nest, and it's a big nest because they're big birds, and they're going to lay about maybe 5 to 6, you know, greeny brown eggs, which the female alone will incubate. But they will build mud within those stick structures,
just and to glue them together,
just to glue them
well
together.
I've seen them bring in plenty of mud. They're both building.
Yes, both adults will build the nest. The female is the one that will do the incubation. So they spend a lot of time building this. And magpies, for their size, are very unusual in that most magpies, not all, will build a roof over the nest. They build a domed sort of nest. So that's a very complicated structure.
Take that, Dermy. And as for the collective noun, well, we have choices.
A charm, a gulp, or a tiding. Even a parliament and murder have been used, although these two are more commonly associated with other corvids, such as rooks and crows. Dr. Richard Collins.
Well, I prefer to use the term ceremonial gathering, is what you see in the literature, rather than parliament. It's a parliament of crows, but a ceremonial gathering of magpies.
The humble magpie. All on nature on one from Monday. And on the county measure, it was calving time. And this offering from Kevin McGahern.
When you think of calving, you might think of tight-fisted farmers, little to be at but staring at lakes, eating the dinner from a drawer, peeling an orange in their pocket. You know, the cute calving stereotype. Neil Tobin has a lot to answer for. As a proud son of Breffni, I'm not sure I'd agree to the mean stereotype. But yes, I can attest to the staring at lakes due to the sheer number. 365, it said. Practically no vista is without a view of one. But there's much more to appreciate, with its hills, forests and lush hedgerows, burrens, dykes, dunkels and drumlins. It's an unspoilt and uncultivated terrain, unyielding to the march of time. A place of living heritage with its lilters and mummers, wren boys, banbeggin and cluedogs. This continuity is reflected in the distinct dialect with its influences of Scottish planters and Norsemen, its vestiges of visceral Elizabethan English in everyday speech, a place where the vowel exchange still holds sway. Phrases like "fierce hate off that fire" and "you can't bait a cup of tea" still ring true. Something I've noticed that's curiously Cavan is our habit of adding on a redundant appendage to a sentence that has absolutely no business being there at all. I was down the town last night, so I was. Tipped into Fitch's, so I did. Slasher had the new woman with them, so he had. There's a humour and colour to the Cavan dialect all of its own that I've great affection for. Where else would you hear a phrase such as "Look at yon Haverill running onto the pitch to start a schmozzle," or "Get your feet off that couch, you clatty dog," or "What are you foostering at there, Gahala?" Or even "That's an ogeous day, hey," which, depending on the inflection, could mean the sun is splitting the stones or it's raining from the heavens. In a rapidly homogenised world with real-time erosion of regional dialects, I'm proud to come from a place that has a distinct voice and character. So I am.
Kevin McGahern on all things Cavan on the County Measure. Back in a bit. Welcome back. With the Darcy, Campbell Jensen, Thor Jensen and Ashley Campbell. And Ashley's father is the late country legend, Glen Campbell.
It's knowing that your door's always open and your path is free to walk that makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and ink stains that have dried upon sunlight that keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory, keeps you ever gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy, granite on their columns now that binds me, or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be cursing or forgiving when I walk along some railroad track and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory. For hours you're just gentle on my mind.
That is quite beautiful. And Ashley talks to Ray about helping her father when he got ill.
Did you step back to help your mum care for your dad when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Is that the way it went?
Well, I guess step back from the normal course of, you know, a young 20-something's life.
Yeah.
But I stepped forward into the role of,
yes,
care,
of course,
caregiver.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially because we were touring with him, you know. It wasn't just taking care of him at home. It was taking care of him on stage as well. So I would just make sure he was okay and kind of lead him in the right direction if he needed help on stage, if he lost his way or forgot what song was next.
And of course, people would have seen I'll Be Me. And that, it's like it's 10 years. That's 10 years old now, is it?
Gosh, that's crazy to think that. But yeah, my dad passed away in 2017, and we stopped touring. The last show was in November of 2012, so it's been a while.
And I read last night why it's called I'll Be Me.
Yeah.
That's because it's funny, isn't it? Because because when you talk to people who care for people with Alzheimer's, there has to be a lot of humor in it. It's humor and it's sort of a coping mechanism.
Yeah, the director, James Keach, he said, hey, Glenn, you know, we're making a movie about you. And my dad goes, oh, really? I'll be me.
And he was.
Yeah, he sure was.
So this is your dad, and you're in this clip as well.
I walk into the kitchen to get something, right? And I go in and I said, now what did I come in here for? I stopped it. I quit going into the kitchen.
Okay. You ready?
Don't introduce these. Who are these people up here? there they are.
Just me for now.
Okay. This is my
over there.
Yeah, my kids and friends and whoever else is here.
Hi.
My darling.
Introduce me, Dad.
Huh?
Introduce me.
I have. I got it right here. I had to write it down or you would have got it first.
You're funny.
Anyway, my darling daughter, Ashley.
And hearing that clip brought Ashley back to that moment on stage.
You know, it's gradual. It's a gradual thing with Alzheimer's, especially, you know, being on stage and all that. You can, as a caregiver, you can tell when they actually don't know and when they're just searching for the word, when they recognize you, but they're searching for the word, or when they really don't know. And that moment later on was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how about the reaction? Because it's 10 years now. So lots of people have seen it, and lots of people who are carers for people with Alzheimer's have seen it. And I would imagine they've reached out to you and your family and your mum to let you know how that documentary affected them.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway I often get is when people, you know, thank us for making the film and for making them feel seen as well, that they're not alone and that everyone goes through it, whether you're, you know, working in a supermarket or you're Glenn Campbell on stage.
Ashley Campbell with Ray on Thursday. On Tuesday's Liveline, a bit of a scrap, private schools and discrimination. But in this instance, it was not quite what you would expect. The Department of Education is now giving free school books for students in the junior cycle. Hooray! But if you're going to a fee-paying school, you'll have to buy them. For Kate, the opening caller, not fair.
I see that as divisive because when everybody was, when the actual electricity was being given to people, mm-hmm. it was across the board to everybody. And a lot of people, unfortunately, parents have to take the step of going to the fee paying school because the school that is near them mm-hmm. is not suitable. It could be actually oversubscribed or may have perhaps a drug problem in the school. And they may have to carpool. So I had a coffee morning this morning, and I had people from around the country. Some were absolutely delighted with the whole thing because, you know, they had all the free books and all happening.
Yep.
Another woman was saying that she and her husband were both out working, and they were struggling to send two mm-hmm. to school because one was in first year, the other in second year, but they had to have two lots of books.
Now, the cynics out there might raise an eyebrow, crested blazers and on bail bucked, but Kate was not a lone voice. Turns out, it could be a lot more complicated. Here's Yvonne.
I was forced to send my daughter to a private school. I applied for a secondary school, the local secondary school, when she was like 2 months old. Okay. She did not get a place at 12. The secondary school that I applied for, the school of boys, I suppose, was, you know, I know that mm-hmm. the priority for those kids is, you know, past pupils who may not even be living in the area where the children are allowed to attend. So there's several types of kids who are given priority to access to that particular school. And as a result, I was just not given the place. If I wanted my child to go to a local school, I had to go private. Don't mm-hmm. make no mistake about it. It's a huge sacrifice. But it's a sacrifice I had to make. I had no choice.
So you could have done with this free, that the vast 90% of your daughter's age yeah. group will be getting because they're going to state
yeah.
schools.
I mean, like I pay my taxes just like all the other parents who get a non-paying fee place. Why am I being discriminated against?
But then, pushback. Here comes Sharon.
Hello, Joe. My point is I don't think private schools should be paid any money out of the public coffers.
Okay.
For school books, Rathmel. At the end of the day, private schools do have a lot more facilities than what the ordinary schools have, sporting-wise, education-wise, every way.
Okay.
Plus, it is a parent's choice to send a child to a private school. That lady there said
Kate, yeah.
about the distance you might have to travel to a school in the sticks.
Yeah.
Well, an awful lot of parents have no choice only to send their children to school in the sticks because they can't afford private school.
Still on the line and possibly eye-rolling.
My God.
Well, who's saying my God? Kate?
I am.
Yeah, why?
Here it comes.
You're saying you're making sacrifices. The ordinary person out there is making sacrifices too by sending their child to a school in the sticks because that's the only school they can send them to because they can't afford private school.
But neither can the others, but they don't have an alternative.
Well,
they have to work.
Have
two parents
they
working.
It.
More working. They have to afford it because
like in my
the
house,
only other
two
alternative.
Parents work. Like in our house, two parents have worked.
Mm-hmm.
But we still couldn't afford a private school, so we had to send our children. We sent our four children to public schools. Our four children got on absolutely fantastic. They're out working in the working world today, paying their taxes. And why should they be paying their taxes for other children to be getting free school books in private schools that you can afford to pay for?
Well, my very point is that you can get very, very good public schools, and that's absolutely wonderful. But when they're not there and you can't...
But sure, they are there.
They're not
able to... But sure, the schools are there.
They're not.
The
I
schools
can tell
are
you that
there,
not.
But people are
the other
willing.
Lady said in
I mean, the first lady.
Not there.
Well, where I live in Kildare, the first lady who came on said that, the local school could have a drug problem. I mean, that was an absolute disgraceful thing to say.
It
so a private
any,
school wouldn't have a drug problem. So a private school wouldn't have a drug problem, but the local school down the road
every,
could have.
Every school could have a drug problem.
Any school could have issues.
I know, but she made that as one of
Kate,
her points of sending the child for private school was, because the local school could have a drug problem. That was disgraceful.
Oversubscribed.
Disgraceful.
Ooh, and then Leslie phoned in with a different perspective. She's now principal in a DESH school. However, she had also taught in a private school. But Leslie was not for the private education privilege begetting privilege, an argument met by a world-weary Joe.
They are choosing to put their children into a certain environment, to be friends with certain people, to have a certain amount of co-curricular. Rugby, for example, would be a huge choice why some parents might make a particular school. Or they want to continue on handing down, I guess, a social mobility from one family to the next, parents, grandparents, all of that.
Well, that happens anyway, Leslie. That happens anyway. I'm sorry.
It does happen anyway, Joe, but the difference is that the state shouldn't be providing and facilitating that to happen. So whatever way parents choose to spend their money is absolutely fine. You can send them away to France. You can pay music lessons. I wouldn't condone any parent for wanting to do that for their child. But the state should not be facilitating inequality. And at the end of the day, these arguments always come up when it's privileged, advantaged children that are feeling some level of injustice.
Leslie's point made. And then another caller phoned in, Brian. But after a few minutes, Joe went back to Leslie.
Unless you're a different bit. You're the Social Democrat candidate.
I am indeed for Cliniche Hill, yeah.
And why didn't you tell us that?
Well, because I wasn't going
Because the election is coming up in 6 weeks. I've got to be fair. You know, so I'm only asking people to be fair, Leslie. You are a candidate in the upcoming local elections.
Well, actually, that's why I didn't name it, because I thought that would be unfair, actually.
How people would dare you. While Brian was talking there, and apologies, Brian, I looked up your name, and up it came, Leslie Bourne, Social Democrat candidate. Come on. Now, that doesn't negate your views, but just I'm asking people to tell us.
I've 20 years of education.
Yeah, I know, I take that, but it is Social Democrat policy.
Mon Dieu, quite the diversion. Candidates unmasked. But getting us back on topic through the medium of rugby. John.
I just find this whole conversation astonishing, to be honest, Joe.
Okay, why?
A number of points, I suppose. Firstly, I'll give you an analogy. I went to a school in Leinster before I moved to Galway.
Yeah.
And it was a non-fee-paying school.
Yeah.
And I played rugby.
Yeah.
And the Leinster Senior Cup, which is a competition mainly made up of 6th-years, some 5th-years, which is the top team in each school, has only been won twice by non-fee-paying schools. In 1983 and 1985 And the point I'm making is this.
What does that mean?
Is that if there's not an advantage in these schools, and I'm not just talking about education, I'm talking about extracurricular activities. And there is an advantage in the likes of Black Rock and Clongowes and Newbridge and, you know, Ross Grey. Of course there is.
What is it? Okay. Well,
I'll give an example.
Tell me what it's got.
Our coach was a teacher.
Okay.
Our coach was a teacher, giving his free time to coach us, and he taught us.
Okay.
You go to Black Rock or something like that, there's a guy employed to train the senior team. Now, not an advantage, if that's not an example. Also, that teacher that was on there was saying that she knows of many people who go to fee-paying schools who scrimp and scrape and don't have the big car and the big holiday.
Hmm.
Why are they doing that if it's not an advantage? A lot of these people were born on third base, Joe. And they think we're all equal. We're not. And it's not fair.
Yeah, but
it isn't fair.
I know life isn't
fair. So what
fair,
we're doing, Joe,
no,
is...
Can I ask you another question?
We're making a business out of education, just like we're doing with the health system. Did Norma Foley handle this badly? Yes, she did. Because what the emotive argument then can be put forward that, oh, we're discriminating against kids, which is absolute and utter nonsense.
Not a dull moment. Lifeline. On Tuesday's Arena, live from Studio One, and Afrobeat special with Ian Carey and friends.
It is so brilliant to have you here with us, Segun. I say Afrobeat to you, what does that mean?
Oh, Afrobeat, it means culture. It's deep, you know. It means blood. It means heritage. Yes.
It's more than music.
Yes. Yeah.
But undoubtedly, the beat part of that tells us that beat is what it's all about.
Yes, it's a groove. It keeps, you know, it drives that groove into you and makes you dance. It makes you want to get up and move and shake your body.
The origins of Afrobeat, we're going back, I guess, to your native Nigeria. We're going back to Africa, obviously, Segun. How important was Fela Kuti in the establishment of Afrobeat?
Oh, wow. Fela created the genre and he used the music to speak to power. He used it as a form of fighting oppression for the people. He used it as a tool for educating the people on their rights, you know? And he was persecuted for it. For me, it's a tool that Fela gave to all Africans, not just myself, to continue to use it to fight for what is just.
Ian Carey and friends, Arena's Afrobeat special. Well worth a listen back. With Oliver yesterday, Chris Eubank, the boxer, was massive in the 90s and he played Steve Collins in an epic fight in Cork in 1995. A new documentary, One Night in Mill Street, explores the super middleweight world title clash. And when Eubank spoke to Oliver, well, he was part showman, part preacher. Not a lot has changed.
One thing that was particularly unique, as I mentioned at the start, you were hugely entertaining. You were flamboyant, you strutted around the place. Were you trying to wind people up?
No, I wasn't. Hold on, look. You know, do what it says on the tin. So, you know, if you're a waiter, then you have you deport your way in a particular way. You know, I'll be with you right now, ma'am. Just give me one moment. I'm just handling this particular customer. You talk a particular way, you act a particular way, you look a particular way. So in boxing, your life is on the line. So what then should be your attitude? How would you walk? How would you talk? You know, would you be smiling all the time? Would you be swearing? Would you be... To me, it was like, do what it says on the tin. So, which is, you know, you speak correctly, decently. You use a vocabulary. You know, you speak straight into camera. You have, when it comes to the way you look, style. You know, what happens when you become champion of the world, the belt that they put around your waist, what that does is that that attracts the spotlight, the cameras.
Yes.
So the cameras or the media, they put the spotlight on the person wearing the belt. So then the spotlight is listening to and watching the way you dress and what you say. Who are you?
And they talked about that Mill Street fight. And at the press conference beforehand, Steve Collins took a particular stance.
He cast doubt on your identity as well, which certainly, looking at it now, feels like a step too far.
Well, no. No, no. You have no other choice. You have to get into my mind. You have to unnerve me in saying, you know, I'm an Irishman. I do for the Irish people. You say you're an Englishman. We know you're an Englishman. You act like an Englishman, but you're an African. What have you done for the Africans? He won the fight at that particular... That's what won him the fight.
Wow.
Because at that point, I was like, I can't explain all of the intellectual backlog of Chris Eubank being a black man, being a person who is second generation here in Britain, a Jamaican, the African slave trade. You know, I'm having to deal with... So what I couldn't do is explain what he said and how wrong what he said was, because I'm dealing with a tabloid newspaper, and tabloid newspapers are just about clickbait. You know, they're not going to listen to my history. And all of that, you know, made my spirit angry. And when you're angry, you're not thinking about the objective, which is to score points.
And he would lose that fight on points with unanimous decision from the judges. But Oliver took him back to the pageantry, the spectacle of it all, and it is fair to say it was kind of nuts.
Your name is in fireworks. You rise up from a platform out of the ground sitting on a customised Harley Davidson. I mean, nobody would dare do that today, would they?
Well, sorry, you know, yes. Why wouldn't, yeah, you can do that, but can you back it up? Can you
back it up?
Can you be in a fight that you can't win and you keep on going, especially when you truly can't? When you can't go on anymore, can you carry on? And if you can do that, then you will iron stamp your being into the hearts of the people. So you know, I've realized now that it's not about the belts. It's not about the championship belts. It's about the hearts of the people.
Hmm.
And you only win that through showing fortitude, testicular fortitude, courage beyond measure, and gentlemanly conduct at the same time. You always have to be a gentleman.
A surprisingly sweet Chris Eubank. But would he have the fortitude to keep silent? Like Lulu, who was in the news this week because she saves her vocal cords by uttering not so much as a word before midday, sparking a thing called speech fasting. Sharp intake of breath from Radioheads everywhere. On Drive Time with Sarah, Trinity College Professor of Psychiatry Brendan Kelly.
The thing that silence brings is an awareness of how much we talk. And sometimes we don't know this. So, for example, Sarah, I used to imagine myself as very much the strong, silent, brooding type. But it turns out I'm a complete chatterbox and I never shut up. And I only realised this when I was silent and people thought I was ill or needed help. But what I found after the couple of days of silence, you know, a little difficult at first, but then you just grow into it. And at the end, you know, you don't want to leave that silence. Yeah. You want the silence to continue. It feels right. And every sound feels like an intrusion after that stillness.
Yeah, you know, I actually totally get you. I would love that, I think.
Panic in the radio studio. One to try on your own time, Sarah. But as human beings, we can find silence challenging.
We live in a very verbal society, a very cognitive society. We think we can sort everything out by talking about it. And I know that's very much what you do, Sarah. You sort out all kinds of things across Ireland by talking about them on the radio. but maybe sometimes silence is a better way to go. Now, we do need to talk a bit. There's also research showing that being entirely silent for conversations, it decreases your likability. People find it very strange indeed. And people often stop talking. And I found this myself, that if someone is talking and talking and you literally can't stop them, if you remain completely silent and say absolutely nothing, they stop talking very quickly. They need the feedback. So we are very interpersonal. So sudden, unexplained silence can come across as a bit odd. And you might find people thinking that there's something wrong. But it's really nice because not speaking, being silent does make you realise how much absolute rubbish we talk and how many of our thoughts simply pass and are possibly best not shared. Or as someone once told me, your thoughts are so precious, you need to keep them safe in your head and not say them at all.
Well, Brendan, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And actually, do you know, it's one of the reasons I love radio, because the power of silence is never more obvious, I think, than on radio. Let's just try it for a second. See? It's just amazing, isn't it? Anyway, Brendan, are you still there?
Sarah,
see, look, I panicked. I wasn't able for it, Brendan. I wasn't able for the silence.
You weren't able for it at all.
Not the better of it. Let's just conclude things. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.